Hello and welcome to Deep North, the official podcast of Iceland Review magazine. Today we'll be listening to editor Erik Pomrenki read his article White Sahara about the new highland base in the Kettlingafjöll mountain range. And afterwards we'll be engaging in a brief conversation about the article.
The west-facing windows of our super jeep, or more correctly, super van, have turned to ice, blasted by the sharp winds coming off the highland. Inside, it's warm, and the loud mechanical whirring of pneumatic pistons mingles with the sound of ice crunching under our vehicle's heavy, well-studded wheels. It's minus 12 Celsius outside, and the visibility is decreasing quickly. So, who here's already been to Kellingafjöll? Our guide, Brynhildur, asks. Nearly all present raise their hands. And who here's been here in the winter? Brynhildur asks. Again, nearly all hands go up. I'm starting to get an uneasy feeling in my stomach. The journey is long. Even with the considerable horsepower of our van, the wheels lose their grip here and there, and we free ourselves either by rocking back and forth or by a tow line from another member of our convoy. During one particularly arduous stretch, we covered just 500 meters in 1 hour. The powerful pneumatic system, located a short distance behind my skull, empties and fills our tires on demand. Anyone who's seen a polar bear hunt in a nature documentary will know the principles at play here. To avoid breaking through a thin crust of ice, the bear flattens itself out, spreading its weight. Our supervan struggles on, inching up steep slopes and plowing through meters-deep snowdrifts. Finally, as the sun sets over the highland, we crest a final hill and look down at the warm lights of the highland base camp, a new hotel and one of the largest ever developments in the highland. It is a welcome sight, and we are among the first travelers to see it. It's 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'm still wiping the sleep from my eyes as we stand next to our skis limbering up. We're standing in the hotel hallway in full gear, practicing the basics, adjusting our poles, clipping and unclipping from our skis, and recovering from a fall without disrupting the skiers behind. In a moisture-wicking base layer, thick socks, fleece, and a windproof shell, I begin to sweat. I'm eager to get outside. It's just like learning to dance, our ski instructor Brynhildur cheerfully informs us as we shuffle outside. This is advice that has generally not boded well for me. But as we get into it, I see that the dancing bit is not entirely inaccurate. It's not the poles, after all, that generate the forward momentum. It's one's legs. One can, in fact, cross-country ski without poles, though I wouldn't recommend it. The trick is finding a rhythm between pushing off with your legs and letting yourself glide. Sounds easy enough, but finding the rhythm in between hard patches of ice, wind gusts, and generally uncoordinated limbs can prove difficult. Still, sure enough, after some laps around our practice track, I get into the swing of things. Next, we move on to proper pole usage. The poles are never to be put out in front at an angle, I'm told. The trick is to keep them vertical and then fully extend them behind. Those who quickly mastered handling their poles then graduate to an advanced gait, which involves a rhythmic cycle of gliding, shuffling, and kicking. I regret to report that I was not nominated to graduate to the advanced gait, but I was soon enough confidently punting my way around the practice track. To round off the day, we begin learning the basic techniques of cross-country skiing downhill. When braking, for example, one is never to hold the poles out in front. Brynhildur mimics being impaled. Noted. In fine alpine fashion, we conclude the day of skiing with champagne in the loft of the Kellingafjöll Hotel. The Icelanders discuss an upcoming winter expedition across the Fimmvörðuháls Pass, a trail connecting the popular Laugavegur hiking trail with the south coast. while a German and an Australian wax poetic about the surroundings. It's hard to blame them. The panoramic view of the winter highland is all the better after a day of hard work on the slopes. After a dinner of filet mignon and sorbet, we relax in the natural hot springs and stargaze. Cross-country skiing is fun and all, but I'd be perfectly content if the trip consisted of nothing more than this. And later in the evening, we join in a traditional Kvöldvaka, an evening of drinking and song. Such nocturnal revelries have their roots in the early days of the ski school here, when Kerlingafjöll was a much humbler place. Young people would cram into the loft of the old lodges here, strum guitars and drink schnapps late into the night. Tonight, our accommodations are considerably more sumptuous than those of a generation or two ago, but something of that spirit is clearly in the room as we raise our glasses and voices into the cold, clear night.
Destination Kerlingafjöll. It is only relatively recently that Kerlingafjöll has become known as an outdoor destination. Prior to the 21st century, local farmers had little reason to explore the highland area, and most thought it the haunt of outlaws and trolls. Indeed, the name Kerlingafjöll might be best translated as the Hag Mountains, a reference to the traditional connection between uninhabited places and the supernatural. Many peaks, glaciers, and valleys here had no names until recently. The first human construction in these mountains was a small hut raised by Ferðafélag Íslands, the Icelandic Touring Association, in 1937. In 1961, a ski school was founded in Kerlingafjöll that operated during the summers until the turn of the century, when the area stopped receiving consistent snowfall in the summer. With the growing popularity of the region, Kerlingafjöll also saw a rising demand for services. Original plans for the highland base detailed some 120 double rooms, but after calls by concerned environmentalists, the hotel was scaled down and redesigned to better blend in with the landscape. At a total cost of 2 to 3 billion krona, approximately $20 million or 17 million euros, the highland base at Kerlingafjöll is the largest ever investment in the Icelandic highland, with the exception of hydropower plants. The scale of the project also sparked the political will to formally protect this area of the highland. In 2020, 344 square kilometers, 133 square miles, were designated a conservation area in what many, including then Minister for Environment and Natural Resources, Svandís Svavarsdóttir, celebrated as a win for the environment.
Daði is known informally as the captain of Kerlingafjöll. And though it's partly a tongue-in-cheek title, it's not entirely. The day-to-day of managing a highland base camp cum luxury hotel, after all, requires Daði to be equal parts mountain guide, receptionist, and all-around handyman. An average day here is nothing like the ordinary, Daði tells me. There's always something you have to figure out. I need to take care of the whole area, and it's like a small village. In the summer, a typical day begins with me waking up early and setting up the breakfast buffet. Then, around 10 or so, I might have to fix a tire. I'm always fixing tires, he adds ruefully. Then, in the afternoon, I might need to fix a window and take care of our customers until dinner, so it's always something. He tells me that working here in the winter is much the same, except that the snowmobiles also need looking after. Daði also explains that simply getting visitors to Kerlingafjöll is its own challenge. We're always sure about how many people we're expecting, and if they don't arrive, then we need to go out and find them. Sometimes a jeep might get stuck, and then it's up to us to assist them. Incidentally, this is a duty of Daði's with which I'm already familiar. Despite the horsepower of our supervan, we stranded briefly on the rough highland track. It was Davi in his super jeep named Emma that ultimately guided us to the warmth and comfort of our lodgings. Such difficulties remind one that despite the luxurious lodgings and elegant atmosphere at Kerlingafjöll, one is indeed in the middle of nowhere. I can think of no better illustration of this tension than our fellow guests for the weekend, a corporate group holding a private party that seemed to have much more to do with the clubs of downtown Reykjavik than the Icelandic Highland. It is a curious dynamic that leads me to wonder who exactly is Kerlingafjöll for these days. I think the Highland has been quite accessible for many years now, Davi goes on. There have, of course, been super jeep enthusiasts and international mountaineers who have frequented the area for some time. But the area is undeniably growing in popularity among a new kind of traveler who doesn't necessarily have the same kind of gear or experience as these other types. We see a lot of people who want a real adventure, Davi says. They come here to see the mountains, to experience the weather in a way you just can't on television or social media. You can actually feel it on the skin. You can come here, you can stay in the hotel, you don't even have to leave the hotel if you don't want to. Some people just want to experience the dark nights and see the aurora, for instance. The beauty of the new Highland base at Kerlingafjöll seems to be that travelers no longer have to choose between an extreme outdoor adventure and the comfortable luxury of hot springs, saunas, and champagne. As more and more people find out about this hidden gem of the Highland, it's inevitable that this area will see quantities and kinds of visitors previously unheard of in this region. As Davi says, I think there's so much at Kerlingafjöll for everybody, and I think it's only going to grow in the years to come. But it's also important to take care of the nature here. And maybe the best way to do this is to educate the people who come. That's really important to us. We always have guides on the premises to talk to everybody, to teach them how to best view the surroundings. Maybe that's the best way to take care of what we have here.
The Highland area, known as Kerlingafjöll, is located between the glaciers Hofsjökull and Langjökull, some 50 kilometers northeast of Gullfoss Waterfall, as the crow flies. This proximity to Gullfoss Waterfall, with its cafes and gift shops, may make it sound relatively accessible, a quick stop on a day tour of the Golden Circle. But even in the summer, the rough track can be difficult to navigate. In the winter, nothing but the largest, most powerful super jeep will do. To the traveler approaching Kerlingafjöll, the mountain range appears as nothing so much as a highland fortress. From the banks of the Kvitau River, a long plateau gently rises to the north. Atop this motte sits a bailey of jagged peaks, including Fannborg, Hveranúkar, Snækollur, Snót, and Loðmundur. All of them are among the 100 highest in Iceland. This complex of peaks is a mature volcano, characterized by diverse eruption patterns, geothermal springs, two prominent craters, and striking rhyolite colors. During the summer, the rhyolite gives the area a distinctive and vibrant color, much admired by the hikers, mountain bikers, and social media influencers who come here in droves. The oldest rock formations at Kerlingafjöll are about 336,000 years old, with volcanic activity prominent during the last glacial and interglacial periods. Minimal seismic and volcanic activity has been recorded here in recent years, making the area about as calm as it gets on a volcanic island.
Early next morning, we are treated to a generous breakfast buffet that was rather inexplicably, to me at least, paired with a sound of Taylor Swift. The pineapple in the fruit salad seems somehow fresher than the stuff I buy in town, and heaps of sliced cheeses, deli meats, scrambled eggs, and pain au chocolat greet the browsing skier. Some shot glasses are arranged on an elegant tray, next to the canisters of water and orange juice. It seems a bit early for that kind of thing, but as I later see, the shot glasses are intended for the doctor's recommended daily intake of lisi, cod liver oil. I see our guide, Brynhildur, doing a bottoms-up with other guides. Health-wise, they might be onto something, but I can't help stifle a reflexive retch from childhood memories of the stuff. Not long after, we clamber into Davi's super jeep, Emma. As we soon learn, Emma is a minor celebrity among off-road vehicles. Along with her driver, Davi, she was the first vehicle to cross Greenland from east to west, and then back again. It took some 3 to 4 weeks each way, Davi tells me. With 120,000 kilometers on her odometer, Emma has also driven on every major glacier in Iceland. Outfitted with 44-inch wheels, she sits atop 3 separate fuel tanks, carrying a total of 240 liters of diesel when fully topped off. The pressure of each tire is individually controlled through an app on a smartphone mounted to the dashboard. We are driving across a mountain plateau known as Ásgarðsheiði, the Asgard Heath. It is an area that feels mythological, and Davi tells me that 2 crows are known to live here. He's named them Hugin and Munin, thought and memory. Odin's ravens. Our mission today is to catch a glimpse of the Hveradalir geothermal valley and then rendezvous with our ski group. In the summer, Hveradalir is known for the vibrant colors of its rhyolite cliffs and mineral deposits from the geothermal springs. Now, in the middle of winter, it's a white Sahara. White cliffs against a white sky loom over us. White snowdrifts snake across the white ground. Even the sun, in its blinding clarity, appears white. We stop on a ridge that overlooks the valley. The river that flows through it is some of the only water in this region that remains unfrozen in the winter, heated by the many geothermal vents and springs that dot the valley. It's a spectacular sight, but the wind is picking up, and we re-embark into Emma. The ski group comes into view as we descend Ásgarðsheiði. Brightly colored Gore-Tex shells standing out in sharp relief to the blasted white surroundings. As we disembark from Emma, I sense a charge in the air. Walkie-talkies crackle and click in the wind. We're surrounded by expert guides and experienced skiers, but this windswept heath is not a place that anybody wants to linger. The wind is picking up as we strap on our skis. Before us, the northeast edge of Kerlingafjöll stands Loðmundur Mountain, the so-called King of Kerlingafjöll. At 1,432 meters, it is not the tallest peak here, but its distinctive shape has earned it a place in the heart of mountaineers. It is also the most technical peak to summit in this range, skirted by steep slopes on its sides, its top ringed by near-vertical cliffs. Everybody warm, good to go, Brynhildur yells atop the wind. We can't afford to stop at length. Cross-country skiing in this environment is a delicate balance. Stay still for too long and you cool down. Overheat and you sweat through your layers, a potentially dangerous situation in extreme temperatures. The current temperature is minus 15 C, with wind gusts up to 30 meters per second. A long, broad slope extends before us. A switchback trail cuts zigzags through the snow, and the more experienced skiers have already pushed off. With little time to lose, I begin my descent. There is an art to cross-country skiing downhill. While downhill skiers can simply form a pizza shape with their skis to slow down, it's important for cross-country skiers to remain in the ruts that have been cut into the ice-crusted snow by their fellow travelers. This means that conventional braking methods are out the window, and I must instead time my descent such that I lose momentum where the switchback turns, dragging my poles in the snow if need be. Once stopped, I cut my slope-facing foot into the side of the hill, and with the other, I take a conspicuously large goose step and turn my foot in the other direction. Once secure, I repeat the procedure with the other foot, and then it's downhill again. Through the constant rebalancing and readjusting, I discover muscles in my feet previously unknown to me. It's a relief when we reach the bottom, where we resume our shuffling and kicking. After a brief respite, we head off out again across the flats of the plateau. Loðmundur is at our back, and a sharp wind picks up from the northwest. The wind is unrelenting, but fortunately, there are times when it's at our backs, catching our shells in the wind like sails. The temperature is dropping, and we have several kilometers to go before we return to base camp. The group sinks into the silence of grim determination, pushing on through ice patches, snowdrifts, and uphill slopes. During particularly sharp blasts of wind, a burst of mad laughter picks up along the column. It's infectious, and I join in, howling at the wind. By the time we return to base, I can honestly say this trip has been one of the hardest things I've ever done. It also happens to be one of the best days spent outdoors in my life. As I sit in the supervan bound for civilization, I think about distance and time. From Gullfoss, the nearest outpost of civilization, it is only some 50 or 60 kilometers to the highland base at Kerlingafjöll. But on the icy highland tracks, it takes 5 or 6 hours to traverse these kilometers, making this corner of the highland just as far removed from Reykjavik as London or Paris. A traveler may well wonder, why come to Kerlingafjöll at all? The answer, it seems to me, is simple. On any other weekend, I could have visited another city, another country. Out here, I visited another world.
Well, thank you for that, Eric.
You're welcome. Thanks for listening.
So when did this trip of yours take place?
Let's see. That was almost a month ago now already, in the middle of February. Yeah.
And what occasioned the trip in the article?
You know, honestly, this is me just being a victim of good advertising. And I just remember, like, all through winter, like, I was just seeing all of these ads on YouTube for this cross-country skiing course in Kerlingafjöll. And I was just like, wow, that actually looks really amazing and cool. As I mentioned in the piece, I'd actually never been out to Kerlingafjöll. And it's just a very different area in the summer. I mean, in a way, I should have, you know, maybe kind of gone out there first in the summer, because I think that's, you know, what the area is really known for, like these really kind of beautifully colored cliffs and hills and everything. But yeah, I mean, it was really just quite amazing. You know, I mean, it's really kind of like another world out there, as cliche as that may be.
Yeah, I mean, anyone growing up in Iceland, I remember my father talking about skiing in Kerlingafjöll when he was younger. And as you mentioned in the piece, this was a popular ski resort, quote-unquote resort, for Icelanders of a certain generation. But there's been significant buildup there over the recent months, years.
Well, yeah, you know, so this ski school stopped operating around the turn of the millennium in like the early 2000s. And it's worth noting that this was during the summer, right? So, you know, I mean, this area was high enough altitude in the highland that there was pretty regular snow coverage even in the summer. So, you know, of course, it's pretty hard to get out there. So, you know, in the 60s and 70s, when, you know, super cheap technology was still kind of primitive, you know, we didn't really have the means of getting out there reliably. So the ski school that was operated out there, that was during the summer. And, you know, I mean, in our lifetimes, the area has stopped getting the consistent snow cover needed to keep that in operation, you know, which is kind of sad. But, you know, so this area still has seen just ever increasing numbers of visitors. I mean, like so many places in Iceland. And, you know, like on the one hand, there was this real need to kind of increase the level of service out there. You know, I mean, it was just a fact that like hundreds, thousands of people are visiting the area during the summer. And, you know, these people all need, you know, basic services. Like they need to be able to go to the bathroom. They need clean drinking water, things like this. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why, of course, the area has developed recently. But, you know, I mean, certainly just the scale of the new highland base at Kerlingafjöll, you know, I mean, it really is a new luxury resort, really. And, you know, like there's different kinds of accommodations out there. There's more just kind of basic hostel accommodations. There's a pretty standard hotel. And then, you know, we were also lucky enough to be in the private cabin suites, which, you know, are just really quite beautiful. You kind of get this nice little window that just kind of looks out over the valley, and you just kind of, you know, sit there with your coffee, just looking out over a pristine highland area. So, you know, it was really special. But, you know, I think there's no denying that, you know, certainly the development has changed the area. Yeah.
Yeah, so there are a few private companies operating hotels and hostels in the area. Am I right?
So it is just one company. So that's the base camp at Kerlingarfjord. Right?
Ah, okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, and so after there were these plans to kind of develop the area, you know, then the area became protected. So, you know, there were these plans. Then there was, you know, so the controversy was that essentially some of the development had begun before doing a proper environmental assessment of the effects of the development. And so there was some environmental concern before the base camp was finished. And so now there's just one provider out there that kind of operates all of this.
Yeah. And tell me about Dade, who is the kind of general manager of the area, of the facilities. What is he like?
Yeah, I mean, Dade was a great guy. I didn't know him the first time that we met because, you know, he was kind of guiding our van in from the dark because our van was running kind of late and we were bogged down in snow. So when I first encountered him, it was kind of like a guardian angel kind of guiding us in from the cold. But no, you know, I mean, like I said, you know, like it's just a totally different environment out there. You know, I mean, I was just really curious as to, you know, what's it like to work out there? You know, I mean, it's obviously one thing to be a tourist, to be an adventurer, you know, to like go out there and hike and stuff. But, you know, like how do you encounter that kind of place when that's just your workplace or your daily life? You know, I mean, something that he was kind of just telling me about was, you know, just how important it is for the whole team to just get along, that everybody like each other. Because, you know, I mean, he was kind of jokingly saying that, you know, it can be a little bit like the hotel from The Shining, you know, like everyone's kind of stuck there for better or for worse, for large parts of the winter. And of course, some of the staff kind of, you know, come and go with the jeeps that visit them, you know, but fundamentally, like when you're out there for a couple of weeks. And you know, it's kind of also his job to really kind of, you know, keep everyone together. Yeah.
Yeah, I got you. And did you have a lot of experience skiing or cross-country skiing before this?
No experience cross-country skiing. I've done some downhill skiing before. And, you know, cross-country skiing, as anybody will tell you, is a very, very different beast. Yeah, I mean, the techniques in cross-country skiing are just totally different. I mean, it's also just, you know, I mean, obviously downhill skiing is challenging and physical in its own ways, but you know, I mean, fundamentally, you're going with gravity. And yes, you know, there's obviously skill and it is very hard on your body in some ways to kind of be constantly shifting your weight and adjusting and everything. But I mean, I think it's not controversial to say that, you know, cross-country skiing is just exhausting in a way that downhill skiing is not, you know, just going like for kilometers and kilometers, you know, through pretty rough conditions sometimes. But you know, I mean, it was really just so much fun. You know, my dad would sometimes joke with me, when I was a kid, you know, like when we were hiking or camping or something, that there's two kinds of fun. There's type one fun and type two fun, and type one fun is fun while you're doing it. And type two fun isn't fun, but it's fun to talk about after. So, you know, I would say it was a little bit more type two fun.
Yeah, that makes me think of, I don't know if I told you this before, but the writer Thorbergur Þórðarson, he had this perfect sort of encapsulation of type two fun where he said, like, when he went to like balls or dances, like, you know, parties in the 1930s or whenever, you know, he always said, I don't really enjoy them while they're taking place, but I do enjoy like thinking of them afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
Sounds like a very kind of literary, authorial way of perceiving fun, which you imagine would belong to category one fun, according to your dad. Yeah, so how long were the treks? How long were you actually skiing?
Yeah, I mean, we just kind of had a little kind of learner's lesson the first day, and that was kind of an all-day thing. But, you know, fundamentally, we weren't like on an expedition. We were just kind of on like a big open area near the Highland base, just kind of practicing the basics, and then, you know, also kind of going up on some slopes and kind of practicing, you know, how you glide down and stuff. And we were out there for pretty much the whole day, but it was really just the second day that we went on, you know, like a big loop basically around the area. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, it was like second day of cross country skiing and you're in the middle of the Highland in winter on like a 10 kilometer loop. And, it was a little bit intimidating at first. But you know, I mean, like I said, it was also just, I mean, it was really just so much fun. And, you know, like I think that there's just a really fun, like group dynamic when people are kind of suffering a little bit together and, you know, you kind of just kind of get to know people in a way that you wouldn't in other, circumstances. You know, just when you're doing something really hard, everyone gets a little bit kooky, but like everyone's on the same wavelength. So that's always kind of just like a fun group dynamic. But yeah, I mean, like we did this nice, loop basically going from the Highland base, up onto this plateau called Ásgarðsheiði, and then kind of coming down and coming around and, you know, just really got to see some beautiful sights from the area. Yeah, also like the mountain Loðmundur, which is just like a very iconic peak in that area. And you know, it was just one of these like really beautiful winter days. You know, I mean, like I feel like so often we associate winter and the dark, you know, I mean, for obvious reasons in Iceland. But you know, I mean, especially this time of year in like February, March, when the sun starts coming out more, you know, like there are these really beautiful, just like bright days where everything is just like white and sparkling and like you basically like blinded just going outside. And, yeah, we were really lucky with the weather. And, you know, I think I was left with a very, very good impression of the area.
Yeah, great. So this is something you would recommend travelers to Iceland do?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. I mean, for me, this is certainly in the kind of, you know, top experiences that I've had here. You know, I mean, it's certainly for a certain kind of person. And, you know, I mean, you know, like that's maybe like one kind of tension, I think, with this area. You know, I mean, it is definitely a luxury experience now. You know, it's like at the same time, it is like a very rugged. And so it's like definitely catering to a certain kind of more experienced outdoors person. But, you know, I mean, I think the beauty of a place like this is that, you know, now a lot more people can experience something that would have maybe just been completely inaccessible to normal people, before this. And you know, I mean, more generally, you know, I mean, there is of course this debate in Iceland with the tourism industry and conservation and preservation and, you know, how do we use Iceland's natural resources in a way where everybody gets to benefit, but they're still preserved. And, you know, I mean, one of the important arguments, I think, is that, you know, there are other areas that need to be developed because we can't just always have the same amount of people always going to the same sites. You know, I mean, when a million people like visit Skógafoss, for instance, every year, you know, I mean, like before they really built up facilities there, I mean, like in the early 2010s, I mean, like there were a couple of years where it was really just trashed. And you know, like there weren't really any proper bathrooms out there. There were just like hikers and backpackers just kind of, you know, just like basically going to the bathroom, like right next to the road. And you know, like what it really took to kind of clean up the area was to, you know, provide a slightly higher level of service and, you know, to also kind of spread the load, you know, because when you have all of these people visiting the same, maybe like 10 sites that they've heard about that are like must see destinations in Iceland, you know, that's also how those areas get degraded. And, you know, when you have, you know, tens of thousands of people hiking the Laugavegur hiking trail every year. You know, that's also how that area gets degraded. And so, you know, I think that for some people, there's kind of like a knee-jerk response to just see like any development as bad because, you know, we're kind of encroaching on a pristine nature or something. But, you know, on the other hand, like there is this real way in which we do need to develop other areas to preserve other areas, you know, because if we kind of spread it out a little bit more evenly, then at the end of the day, like everything gets a little bit more protected.
Yeah. And I mean, it sounds like a really magical place. The prospect of sipping champagne and eating fresh fruit after a long day of cross-country skiing sounds great. And also curious, who was playing Taylor Swift? Was that Dolly?
Yeah, I mean, that was just on the brunch playlist, I guess. I mean, like to me, it was just a little bit surreal because, you know, like you're just kind of out in the middle of the highland. You're kind of in a slightly different state of mind. Everything's kind of quiet and relaxed and a little bit ethereal. And you're about to go on this big nature trip. And then, you know, like all of a sudden, it's just like this kind of like country electro thing going on.
She is everywhere. What kind of music would you have preferred for that moment, Eric?
I don't know. I mean, maybe, you know, just something kind of quiet and classic. I don't know, some John Denver, maybe.
I thought you were going for Sigur Rós, but John Denver.
Yeah, that's right. That worked too.
Well, yeah, thank you for that, Eric. It was an enlightening piece.
Yeah, thank you. Deep North is the official podcast of Iceland Review, the oldest continuously running English language publication on Iceland, covering community, nature, and culture. If you enjoyed listening, please consider subscribing to Iceland Review at our website.